and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the latest incident of domestic terrorism, with the shooting rampage in a cinema in Louisiana carried out by an admirer of Adolf Hitler, who was an anti-abortion fanatic with an extensive record of mental illness, yet was able to purchase the handgun he used to murder innocent young women legally. David Schanzer, professor of the practice and director of the Triangle School on Terrorism and Homeland Security in the School of Public Policy at Duke University, joins us. He had a recent article at the New York Times, "The Growing Right-Wing Terror Threat," and we will discuss how, while 74% of the nation's police and sheriff's departments listed anti-government violence as their top priority, compared to 39% who listed jihadist-inspired terrorism, Washington appears to be fixated on al-Qaeda and the Islamic State. Then we'll look into a story doing the rounds on the internet that Goldman Sachs is alarmed that China is dumping U.S. treasuries while hundreds of billions in capital is flowing out of China. Scott Kennedy, the director of the Project on Chinese Business and Political Economy at the Center for Strategic and International Studies and author of Beyond the Middle Kingdom, joins us to discuss whether there is any instability with the Chinese economy that has had record sustained growth for some time and how significant its current slowdown is. Then finally, we will speak with Edmund Gharib, an internationally recognized expert on the Kurds and Iraq. He is the first Mustafa Barzani Scholar of Global Kurdish Studies at the Center for Global Peace at American University, and we'll discuss the Turkish military assault on both the Islamic State in Syria and the Kurdish PKK in Iraq, breaking a two-year truce between Turkey's military and the PKK. And joining us now is David Schanzer, who's an associate professor of the practice and director of the Triangle Center on Terrorism and Homeland Security in the Sanford School of Public Policy at Duke University. He had a recent article at the New York Times, "The Growing Right-Wing Terror Threat." Welcome to Background Briefing, David Schanzer.
Happy to be with you.
And I spoke with your co-author, Charles Kurzman, at the time the article came out in the New York Times, "The Growing Right-Wing Terror Threat." And I think it was literally the day before the AME massacre at the church in South Carolina, wasn't it?
Well, it was. A very sad timing, yes.
And the point that you were trying to make in the article is that local police forces in the country seem to have realized that the greatest threat that is posed to their communities comes from homegrown terrorism as opposed to foreign-inspired Islamic terrorism.
Well, they rated both threats as significant, but yes, they thought that the threat emanating from anti-government or racist kinds of terrorism was more substantial in their own jurisdictions than the threat from things inspired by groups like al-Qaeda and ISIS.
And the statistics bear that out. Since September the 11th, 2001, 48 people in the United States have been killed by non-Muslim extremists compared with 26 by self-proclaimed jihadists, according to Research Center of New America Foundation.
That's right. I'm not sure if the things in the last 2 weeks have been added into that, but with the massacres in Chattanooga and in Lafayette, But the data still shows that, yes, in terms of fatalities.
So in terms of the latest massacre in at the cinema in Lafayette, Louisiana, the press keep referring to how the shooter bought the gun legally, as though somehow that exonerates the situation, when it seems pretty clear to me that given his history of mental illness, not to mention his proclivities towards Hitler and Nazism, I find that sort of disconcerting. What's your response to that?
Well, imagine if the Supreme Court says you have a right to have a gun for self-defense, you can't be discriminated on gun ownership in terms of what you believe politically. But that said, I do think society should have the power to restrict firearms to people who are mentally depressed, mentally ill. And I think right now the standard for making that judgment is probably much too high. And what I mean is that I think in order to get on a list that you can't purchase legally a firearm, you have to be, you know, essentially mentally adjudicated to be incompetent or mentally ill. And I think that's just too high a standard. Doctors, family members, perhaps ought to be able to notify the authorities and have some sort of proceeding to determine if an individual can is mentally stable enough to have the responsibility and right. It comes together of owning a firearm.
Well, the governor of Louisiana, of course, is running for president as a Republican in this crowded field, Bobby Jindal. He was very defensive when asked about the connection to mental illness and the ease with which you can purchase or get hold of deadly weapons. But the state of Louisiana does not require gun dealers to obtain a state license, and it doesn't limit the number of guns that you can buy at one time, and it forbids local governments from regulating firearms, and it has no law restricting assault weapons or even 50-caliber rifles. And in one study of all 50 states, gun laws concluded that Louisiana had the laxest gun laws in any state. So it would seem that there's a connection there. I don't know, where was this pawn shop where he purchased this 40 caliber automatic pistol?
Well, I'm not an expert on gun control laws, but what I would say with respect to this, you know, ideological terrorism, really seeing it's many of the people who end up engaging in it are have mental illness backgrounds or signs of depression. I mean, even there's a thought, it's not proven, but that the elder Boston Marathon bomber, Tamerlan Tsarnaev, might have been schizophrenic. So, I don't know. Maybe pro-gun advocates would at least, given all the shootings, say there should be some differentiation between some, you know, perhaps buying a handgun for self-defense and buying these, you know, large-scale military-style weapons that can discharge so many bullets so quickly that perhaps the threshold to get hold of one of those ought to be higher. Maybe we could start the conversation there.
So is there, in terms of, given the piece that you wrote in the New York Times, which I mentioned came out on the day before the AME, the massacre in the AME church in South Carolina, which was a survey that asked 382 police and sheriff's department nationwide to rank the three biggest threats from violent extremism in their jurisdiction. And 74% listed anti-government violence, while 39% listed Al-Qaeda-inspired violence. Given that the shooting of the four Marines and the sailor at the military center down in Chattanooga, that, of course, has led to a lot of speculation about the holes in the net in terms of the ability of the government to track people. Since this fellow had spent 7 months in Jordan in 2014, he'd come back, purchased three rifles and a pistol, and had spent a lot of time honing his marksmanship on a firing range, but he somehow went through the cracks. So there are questions about how effective the FBI is, and the FBI Director Comey recently at this Aspen Institute meeting underway, in fact, he said that this was the greatest threat that the Islamic State was the greatest threat that he is addressing. But on the other side, domestic terrorism, what's your understanding of what kind of databases exist with law enforcement and how they're tracked and stuff? Are they up to speed on that, do you think?
Well, my sense is that after the Oklahoma City incident in 1993, that the FBI actually did turn towards this issue and put up a lot of resources. And we actually saw, a calming down of the violence emanating from these movements. But I do think that if you compare the amount of resources that is being poured into trying to find individuals relating to inspired by ISIS or Al-Qaeda, you know, it's to my knowledge, it's larger by multiple factors than what the resources federally that we're putting towards these other threats. That's a judgment for Congress and the FBI, but I think a case can be made that at least we ought to be paying more attention. I do think what we have, and like Al-Qaeda issues as well with these right-wing groups, I think FBI has good connections with leaderships and organizations. What you have is these people who are really not part of a group or organization, who just hold these views, and they are just much, much more difficult to identify and try to make a case on in advance of an incident.
And again, I'm speaking with David Shanzer, who's the Associate Professor of the Practice and Director of the Triangle Center on Terrorism and Homeland Security in the Sanford School of Public Policy at Duke University. He had a recent article at the New York Times with Charles Kurzman, The Growing Right-Wing Terror Threat. And I do recall, though, when Homeland Security was, I think, about to publish a report on the growth of right-wing extremism and how the people are being influenced by social media and right-wing media, there was a hue and cry from the Congress, from the Republican leadership. So is there any impediments to a national debate here?
Well, I don't think there should be. There was some unfortunate phraseology, but I think in that report, but I think its conclusions were sound. And let's put it all on the table. I mean, I think the election of the first African-American president in a country that is moving towards becoming a minority-majority country is very threatening to a small subset of our population. But nonetheless, it's out there. Often these are the individuals who hold these views. Now, you're allowed to hold these views. There's nothing nothing prohibiting you from doing that. The problem is that even a smaller subset of those individuals, you know, might be inclined to engage in violence and furtherance. And the key is trying to identify those people.
But given that there was resistance from the Republican leadership on that report, does that resistance lead to any kind of, but we know, for example, the NRA is definitely an impediment in getting what the President of the United States just recently said to the BBC was his greatest sense of, you know, lack of accomplishment, for the want of a better description. The thing that he most regretted in the time that he's been in office is his inability to do anything about sensible gun safety laws in this country. And I think it's pretty clear where the problem lies in terms of getting legislation. So is there a resistance on the part of conservatives in Congress to recognize this threat, do you think?
Well, I tend to agree that the possibility of getting new gun control laws through the federal Congress is probably pretty slim. You did see some activity at the state level after the Newtown shootings, so in some states, that might be a possibility. And I don't think the debate about gun control ought to affect, for example, the FBI's allocation of resources. And I have a lot of faith in the FBI that those decisions are not made on a political basis. So if they come to the conclusion that we are seeing too many of these incidents, I think possibly putting some more resources towards trying to prevent these kinds of episodes would be warranted. And I think the FBI would take action on that.
So, for example, the Southern Poverty Law Center has an intelligence unit, I guess, and they publish lists and stuff like that. Is that kind of research shared? Because the one thing that seems to both of these terrorisms that you've written about and studied, both the domestic threat and the foreign-inspired jihadist threat, it seems that, you know, the medium, in fact, the medium is the message, is how much the Internet plays a role in all of this.
Well, you know, the Internet is our communications device of this part of the 21st century. Who knows what it will be 25 years from now. So, you know, that's just the reality. The Internet's not going away. And like in all things, law enforcement, our laws, society, you know, has to react to the realities of a new era. And, you know, yes, I agree that the Internet provides, you know, has a lot of impact because it enables people to communicate from very long distances away who wouldn't otherwise have been in touch with each other. It puts vast amounts of material available that is difficult to monitor or restrict in any way, especially in a free society like ours with the First Amendment. But, of course, it also provides opportunities for law enforcement to find people and identify them as they're communicating in ways that weren't possible before. So it is a double-edged sword. And I think, look, if you look at the post-9/11 period, the amount of violence, actual violence we've had, inspired really by either of these ideologies, is still pretty low, whether you compare it to other forms of violence. You know, we have 14,000 homicides per year in our country. Very few of them are ideologically inspired. Or if you compare it historically, we had a larger, much larger number of deaths from ideological violence, many more back in the 60s and 70s than we've had in the decade and plus since 9/11. So in many ways, our law enforcement authorities are doing pretty well in light of the prevalence of the threat.
But one of the problems or the restrictions or holes in the system that FBI Director Comey's talking about is how encryption has become much more commonplace and much more effective, and that in terms of overseas connections between the Islamic State and those that they might inspire here in the United States, it's very easy for them to operate on the dark net and to operate through encryption. And according to Comey and the FBI, they're virtually impossible to deal with. So where do we stand, and just in closing, in that regard, in terms of the battle that's been going on since Edward Snowden, between those that want to have more freedom from the government to look over your shoulder in terms of what you're doing, and the tension with law enforcement who feel that they need these tools to do their job?
Well, I tend to agree with Director Comey on this one. Now, the dark net and the encryption are two sides possibly of the same coin, but they're definitely different problems. In terms of the encryption, I do believe we need new legislation on this. I know the companies are very resistant to having agreements with the government relating to what can be encrypted and what can't, or what can be decrypted, because it's hurting their bottom line, if especially abroad, if they feel that the FBI could eventually have access. But I think the future where our companies, U.S. companies, are spreading around the world totally undecryptable communication devices is a dangerous one. And I think some sort of a combination needs to be made, such that, if the FBI can demonstrate a particular person, communications ought to be able to be decrypted, that somehow, with a judicial review of some sort, that the companies would have some sort of system where that could occur. But that's going to take new legislation from Congress, which I believe has been proposed, and I think it's very important for Congress to take that up.
Well, David Chancellor, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Well, happy to chat with you.
And again, I've been speaking with David Chancellor, who's the Associate Professor of the Practice and Director of the Triangle Center on Terrorism and Homeland Security in the Sanford School of Public Policy at Duke University. He, along with Charles Kurzman, had a recent article at the New York Times, The Growing Right-Wing Terror Threat. We're going to take a brief station break and back, looking into a story doing the rounds on the internet that Goldman Sachs is alarmed that China is dumping U.S. treasuries while hundreds of billions in capital is flowing out of China.
We've all seen enough now, it's time to decide the meekness of love or the power of pride.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Scott Kennedy, who's the director of the Project on Chinese Business and Political Economy at the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington, D.C. He has written extensively about U.S.-China relations, particularly their business and trade relations, and is the author of The Business of Lobbying in China, and he edited China Crosstalk, The American Debate Over China Policy Since Normalization. His latest book is Beyond the Middle Kingdom. Welcome to Background Briefing, Scott Kennedy.
Happy to be here.
And what do you make of this story that's floating around on the internet that China has dumped $200 billion in treasuries in the last few months, and there's been an outflow of something like $500 billion of capital out of China? I'm not sure that the headline or that the evidence reaches the sort of alarm of the headlines, but there's talk that China's dumping treasuries and that Goldman Sachs is sort of absolutely, you know, speechless as to what is happening. So what does your research tell you?
Sure. Well, I never want to speak ahead of Goldman Sachs because they have a lot of investors, investment analysts that spend a lot of time looking at these things. But I think there's probably less there than meets the eye. I don't think it has to do with the Chinese selling off treasuries to cover outflows as a result of the stock market crisis and a panic in confidence in China, although that would, you know, some people could feel that way. I don't think it's a consequence of Xi Jinping or Chinese leaders showing their displeasure with the United States as a result of declining relations and wanting to teach the U.S. a lesson and using the nuclear option of selling treasury bills as a way to do so. I think it's much more simple than that. I think it's really just about changes in China's trade flows and currency flows and a modest sell-off of U.S. treasuries by the central bank to cover that change in flows of finance and trade to try and actually keep the renminbi's value about where they'd like it to be and keep the economy moving forward. I don't think there's anything to it more than that.
And the recent activity on the stock exchange and the extent to which the government had to intervene to stop a run, was that a real crisis or not? I mean, it was at the time, I remember trying to cover it and the comparison was made, you know, that here we are obsessed with the economy of Greece that has a GDP equal to the state of Louisiana, while the second biggest economy in the world is allegedly in free fall. Well, clearly it wasn't, right?
It was not. If you were someone who had bought big into the market in early June this year, it was a crisis for you. But for the Chinese economy as a whole, for most investors, it was not, simply because the decline of 30% was preceded by a run-up of almost 100% or more. And that was really what happened as we saw the bubble pop on the stock market, which really wasn't a reflection of the underlying issues with the economy. China's economy does carry a lot of debt. There's concerns about sort of a long-term slowdown. But this bubble bursting was really a financial issue. It wasn't a reflection of the real economy. And because China has a closed capital account, more or less, it means that it didn't have a big effect on markets elsewhere in the way that the problems with Greece's economy has on the EU and the United States.
So in effect, it was a necessary correction to burst that bubble.
It certainly was. And I think the challenge for China is going to be, are they willing to play less of a role in stimulating the economy and pushing the market up? And when the market goes down, to let it so that it achieves a more market-based equilibrium rather than one set by authorities in Beijing. That's still something that they have a habit of doing, and they need to break in order to make those capital markets function more efficiently and serve the rest of the economy better.
And again, I'm speaking with Scott Kennedy, who directs the project on Chinese business and political economy at the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington, D.C. He's written extensively about U.S.-China relations, particularly their business and trade relationships, and he's the author of Business of Lobbying in China, and he edited China Crosstalk, the American Debate Over China Policy Since Normalization, and his latest book is Beyond the Middle Kingdom. So where would you then place the world's second biggest economy, particularly in comparison to ours? You know, you've got, I guess, on just to pull back and look at the global stage, Europe is still mired in its crisis over Greece, and that's a part of a longstanding inability of Europe to deal with its economy, I think largely because it doesn't really have a central bank, as the United States has, and it was able to rescue itself from the 2008 crash because of the Fed. How would you compare China's economic stopgaps, fallbacks like we have, what Europe has? Where would they stand in relation to what the U.S. has, what the Europeans don't have? What does China have?
Sure. Well, I mean, China is still, you know, quite different from the U.S. and Europe. It's not as advanced industrialized economy the way we are. Its economy has grown extremely fast for 36 plus years now, and the Chinese leadership has a lot to be proud of. At the same time, they still have a very long ways to go to raise per capita income up to advanced industrialized countries' levels. The per capita income in China is around $6,000 to $7,000 per person, which is still less, which is about one tenth of what it is in the U.S. In Europe, the Chinese have improved in manufacturing and have some innovations. We know about Alibaba and Xiaomi and other companies, which are now more famous than Chinese companies in the past. But China still produces at, in general, at lower levels of the value-added chain internationally. And of course, China has a significant amount of corporate debt. Doesn't have a lot of household debt or government debt, but it does have built up a lot of debt of, as a result of stimulus over the past few years, and the result of in the wake of the global financial crisis, and because it has a lot of inefficient state-owned enterprises, and of course, China also has a great deal of inequality. Between gap between rich and poor is quite high along the levels of the U.S., which you wouldn't expect to see at such an early stage of development. So China still has a really long way to go, even though it's come so far over the last 30-plus years. And I think the Chinese recognize that they need to shift their development model and the structure of the economy so that they can have healthier, more productive, more green growth going forward. The challenge is between trying to pursue that goal and at the same time avoiding short-term crises as they faced in the stock market crisis of the last month.
So what kind of data do we have, though, on capital outflows from the Chinese elite? There's a lot of anecdotal information out there. For example, real estate prices in Sydney, Australia, and in Vancouver, Canada. There's this idea that the rich Chinese are not only parking their kids abroad to get education at the Ivy League schools and the better schools in Australia and Canada, etc. They're also, you know, parking their money as well. I know Victor Shi at the University of California, San Diego, is doing an inventory on the Chinese elites and their money. But what's your understanding? Is that, are those stories apocryphal? Is there, because if the elite are parking their money abroad, that would indicate that the elite doesn't have confidence in their own country, which on the surface is a disturbing development if it's true.
Sure. Well, you know, I think the broadest appropriate strategy for dealing with China is one of hedge. China has massive opportunities, and it's displayed those for several decades now, getting many people amazingly wealthy as a result. At the same time, China has huge risks, economic, social, political, environmental. And so whether the United States or Australia or Japan and you deal with China, looking to cooperate where it makes sense, but also hedging against the worst possibilities. And for Chinese who are on the inside and running state-owned companies or government officials or private businessmen, yes, you've done very well. There's still chances that China will continue to do well, but there's also great risks. And so this is really a long story of Chinese hedging their bets, and is not something that has jumped massively in the last year or so. We've, of course, everyone can tell stories, but, you know, we unfortunately don't have the type of data on financial movements and capital flows that we do, for example, on merchandise trade, which is measured quite closely. That's a consequence of the type of financial system that the U.S. and EU built in the wake of World War II, where we don't have the same type of measures. We have a variety of different pieces of evidence from the Chinese, from other central banks, from the Bank for International Settlements. But it is still, in many ways, a guessing game. But my sense is that we aren't seeing anything dramatic of the last few months any different than we've seen over the last several years.
Well, I understand, for example, the Australian economy is slowing because there's a sense that since Australia is a resource-dependent economy and many people describe it as China's quarry, since the Chinese buy so much coal and iron ore, and its economy is highly tied to China, and as a result, it's been doing well over the last couple of decades. So would that be an indication? I mean, there are lots of indications that things are slowing down in China, but again, it's like what you were saying earlier about the stock market. It went up over 100 points and dropped by 30. So what's the big deal? I guess if it's been going up at such an extraordinary rate for so long, if the fact that it slows down by a point or two doesn't seem like a big deal.
Sure. Well, I mean, I think it's still important to distinguish between what's happening in the stock market and financial flow and the rest of the economy. Yes, the economy overall has been slowing gradually. It's now somewhere between 6% and 7%, depending on whose numbers you believe. And that slowdown in the real economy does have direct, explicit consequences for those countries that have plugged into the Chinese growth machine, and certainly countries like Australia, Brazil, and others that have been exporters of commodities to China that have fed into the infrastructure boom are feeling it directly. At the same time, we're not feeling it on the financial side because the direct levers aren't as obvious and they're harder to measure. Certainly, the change in price at Starbucks and the challenges with Greece have had a much bigger effect on NASDAQ and the New York Stock Exchange than the 30% downward spiral in the Chinese stock market. So I think there's a bit of a difference. And one of the things that the Chinese have tried to do in terms of their relationship with the rest of the global economy on the real side, not the financial side, is to emphasize not just importing commodities and having a commodity-based relationship with a lot of countries around the world, but expanding manufacturing collaboration. And so we've seen a great push on the Chinese in Latin America, in Europe, and Australia as well, to talk about expanding Chinese investment in manufacturing in those countries. And I think that's going to be the next wave of outward Chinese investment. And that, if that is the case, then that will mean that the volatility that we've seen of late as a result of changes in China's domestic economy and the infrastructure decline, that level of volatility probably will decline some, and it will be put China's relationship with other countries at an economic level on a more stable foundation.
Well, the president who's just visited Kenya and then has moved on to Ethiopia, he made it pretty clear with this summit with Kenyan entrepreneurs is that the U.S. is in effect trying to play catch up with China's influence and investment in Africa. So where does the Chinese stand in terms of Africa if the U.S. feels it's got to play catch up?
Sure. Well, China's invested billions in Africa over the last decade in many countries, partly for commodities, partly for diplomatic reasons, partly to grow consumption and consumers in those countries. And it's going to continue. for all those types of reasons that you mentioned, for just as a part of, as China's own economy matures, the U.S. is not in a position to dramatically expand its economic ties with Africa. We don't have the type of infrastructure development institutions that the Chinese have. For example, the U.S. Ex-Im Bank, which might be the most closest parallel to China's own Ex-Im Bank and the China Development Bank, is not been refunded by the U.S. Congress and could go out of business. And we don't have any other type of domestic institution which could provide that level of support for American industry abroad. So there's going to have to be a mobilization of commercial investors and institutions to have the U.S. expand its ties with Africa in any type of dramatic way. If there, you know, I think there are reasons to do that totally above and apart from competing with the Chinese. I don't think that the U.S. ought to be interacting in markets around the world and countries around the world simply because the Chinese are there or because they're not there. There are other important reasons because of the U.S.-Africa relationship and because of development in Africa that ought to direct the U.S. in that direction. But I think putting it in the context strictly of what the Chinese are doing is probably really not the starting point for the discussion.
Well, indeed, the Export-Import Bank is subject to a huge controversy on Capitol Hill, with Senator Ted Cruz taking to the floor of the Senate and accusing the Majority Leader Mitch McConnell of being a liar because he thought he had a deal to get rid of the bank. So that's obviously going to continue to be a controversy. But the Chinese, of course, have this infrastructure bank that a lot of countries bought into against the wishes of the United States. We don't have anything like that, and we're doing nothing like the investment that China is investing in infrastructure. I mean, the high-speed rails and the roads and pipelines that connect Beijing with Pakistan and up through Russia now and through the stands, they're investing on a scale that puts us to shame, aren't they?
From direct government or multilateral sources, yes, the Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank that the Chinese launched and now have 56 other countries as members, or 50, depending on how one counts. That is one of several institutions that the Chinese are involved in that are promoting development in Asia and Africa and elsewhere. You know, the U.S., I think, you know, we should see what our comparative advantages are. Comparative advantages that we have very broad and deep capital markets. We do economic and business evaluations and feasibility studies better than anyone. We understand how political institutions are able to grow and develop and work more efficiently, despite what sometimes we see in Washington, D.C. These are strengths that the Chinese do not have. So even though the Chinese are using their own approach in many parts of the world, the U.S. still has its approach, and there's no reason why we can't piggyback on what the Chinese are doing and also operate in other places. So in the stands, and you know, as China builds out the maritime and road part of the Silk Road, land part of the Silk Road, the U.S. can certainly benefit from that, and American business can benefit from it as well. So there's still a lot of things that we can do, and there's no reason that we have to copy in any way what the Chinese are doing. Just as I mentioned before, the U.S. economy is still five times the size of the Chinese economy. We still have much greater technology, innovation, a much better educational system, even a better healthcare system, despite the costs of it. The Chinese have been looking to us for many years from how to model themselves. I don't think that we ought to switch the arrows on that just yet.
But just in closing, though, we, because of political paralysis, for example, at a time when interest rates are at an all-time low, we can't get the investments in infrastructure that are needed for roads, bridges, rails, etc., that are crumbling because of, you know, ideology. I mean, you know, it's such a no-brainer with cheap money to put people back to work, but we're incapable of doing it.
I think that is true, at least in terms of how Washington works. Luckily, Washington, D.C. Doesn't control states and cities and their governments. And a lot of the fantastic innovation that occurs in the United States is occurring outside of the federal government. And the federal government can and should do a lot more. I would agree with you. But until that political paralysis is reduced in Washington, it's really going to be depending on other sources of those local governments and also the private sector to play a much greater role. And so even though that is definitely a drag on things, it could be worse. One of the things about China is you do have a very interventionist government, and you get a lot of very positive things in some ways out of that. But you also get things pulled in the opposite direction in a very difficult and unwise way at the same time. So at least the ups and downs for us aren't as dramatic and as volatile as you can see in China.
Well, Scott Kennedy, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Happy to talk with you, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Scott Kennedy, who's the director of the Project on Chinese Business and Political Economy at the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington, D.C. He's written extensively about U.S.-China relations, particularly their business and trade relationships, and is the author of The Business of Lobbying in China, and he edited China Crosstalk, The American Debate Over China Policy Since Normalization. And his latest book is Beyond the Middle Kingdom. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back talking about the Turkish military assault on both the Islamic State in Syria and the Kurdish PKK in Iraq. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Edmund Garib, who's an internationally recognized expert on the Kurds and Iraq. He was the first Mustafa Barzani Scholar of Global Kurdish Studies at the Center for Global Peace at American University, and formerly was a professor at Georgetown University, George Washington University, and the University of Virginia. And his books include The Historical Dictionary of Iraq, The Kurdish Question in Iraq, The Kurdish Nationalist Movement, and War in the Gulf, which he co-authored with Majid Haluri. Welcome to Background Briefing, Edmund Garib.
Thank you. Pleasure to be with you again.
So it seems that Turkey has, in joining the fight against the Islamic State, responsible for atrocities on Turkish territories and attacking and killing Turkish soldiers across the border with Syria, they've decided to use their air force. They've given permission to the United States to use the NATO air base at Incirlik. But they've also gone after the PKK in Kurdish Iraq, and in doing so, they've broken a two-year truce. So what's the logic behind that, as far as you can tell?
Well, clearly there are a number of factors at work here, and one of them, perhaps the most important, is the failure of the ruling party in Turkey and President Erdogan on gaining the kind of support that he needed to change the constitution in Turkey. And in fact, during that election, he lost his dominance of Turkish politics with the emergence of other parties, and particularly a Kurdish party, the HDP, which has been calling for a political resolution of the conflict and for granting the Kurds their rights. But at the same time, there were also two other parties which had been critical of the Turkish government's regional policies, particularly in Syria, as well as his domestic politics. And these include the People's Party, which is a secular party in the line of Mustafa Kemal Atatürk, the founder of Turkey. And then there is a Turkish nationalist party led by Bahçeli, who has been very critical, actually, was very critical of the government's approach, the government's efforts to reach out to the Kurdish people inside Turkey. And he adopts very strong Turkish nationalist perspectives. So with this kind of result, the government had, first of all, could not ally itself to form a coalition with the Kurdish party, the HDP. They were not very enthusiastic about supporting the secular party, CHP, and forming a coalition with it, although had they been willing to make compromises, I think that might have worked. And the only party, and even there were some tensions, that might have been willing to cooperate, but also they wanted a change in the government's foreign policy, but they wanted, the most important thing is that they wanted the government to continue the fight to prevent what they see as Kurdish secession and Kurdish threat to Turkey's national integrity, as they put it. So other than that, that means that Turkey would have to go back to the new election. And perhaps this is where we might be seeing Turkey moving, the direction that Turkey might be going towards, partly also because these were the domestic elements. Externally, Turkey was also coming under increasing pressure from a number of its allies in Europe, even the United States. The U.S. has been asking for 2 years or so to gain access to the Incirlik air base to participate more effectively in the fight against ISIS in Syria. And Turkey has been very reluctant. They allowed the U.S. to operate in case there were any losses of American pilots. Then later on, they allowed some drones to operate, but that was limited. And so there has been a lot of pressure on Turkey, also because from a number of countries, because they saw it, especially with the rising threat from ISIS to a number of countries and the rising terrorist incidents taking place in the West, in a number of countries in the West. A lot of countries have been critical of Turkey for leaving its doors open, its borders open, to not only to Syrian fighters to go into Syria, but to radical fighters coming from overseas. And so Turkey was coming under a lot of pressure internally and externally. And so as a result, we saw this agreement with Washington to allow for the use of the U.S. Air Forces from Incirlik. And also, if needed, the U.S. could use three other bases in Malatya and Diyarbakir and in Batman, if needed. And at the same time, Turkey, which has been very much concerned about the Kurdish issue, and the government increasingly criticized because by Turkish nationalists, decided also to use this opportunity to launch strikes against the PKK in Iraq. And this is where the situation we find ourselves at right now is that Turkey says that it's going to participate in the coalition against ISIS, although some critics who have already been commenting on this have raised questions. They said we'll have to wait and see whether or not Turkey will go ahead and really join this this battle against ISIS. At the same time, we saw also an escalation against the PKK, and that raises a number of questions. Partly, there have been arrests inside Turkey, hundreds, some people have said close to 700, 670 people, although most of them, according to Kurdish activists, are Kurds, not ISIS. But there are some ISIS, there are some radical Salafist preachers. There was one who was arrested. That has also raised some questions. Well, if Turkey so quickly could arrest these people, why didn't this happen earlier. So it's a complicated issue. Erdogan might think that this would be the way out to resolve Turkey's internal problem, to prevent the YPG, which is a Kurdish nationalist party that has been active in Syria and with the help of the U.S. Air Force has actually regained control of Kobani. He wants to prevent the reunification of two cantons, two Kurdish cantons in Syria between Kobani and Larab and Jarablus, and that's something very significant for him. At the same time, he hopes to mobilize public opinion, Turkish public opinion, especially Turkish nationalists, and to say during the coming elections that he would be the ideal candidate, the best candidate, to prevent the threats to Turkey's sovereignty and Turkey's unity. And at the same time, he also moves towards the West by saying, look, I am willing to join. I'm going to join the fight against ISIS. And so I think overall there may be, I'm sure, other factors as well. But these are some of the issues, I think, behind the activities that we have been seeing recently.
And again, I'm speaking with Edmund Garib, who's an internationally recognized expert on the Kurds in and Iraq. He was the first Mustafa Barzani Scholar of Global Kurdish Studies at the Center for Global Peace at American University and formerly was a professor at Georgetown University, George Washington University, and the University of Virginia. And his books include The Historical Dictionary of Iraq, The Kurdish Question in Iraq, The Kurdish Nationalist Movement, and War in the Gulf, which he co-authored with Majid Khaduri. So, obviously, there's a tit for tat starting here between the PKK and Turkey. Last week, the PKK apparently killed two Turkish police officers, and now a car bomb has killed two soldiers and in a military convoy in southeast Turkey, injuring four others. The fact that the Kurds, as you mentioned, this belt across the south of Turkey from the northern Iraq all the way and two-thirds of the border between Turkey and Syria are effectively controlled by the Kurds, who, as far as the West is concerned, are the only people capable of fighting the Islamic State. Turkey has clearly been ambivalent up until now. So what do you think is the future? Do you think that since Iraq is sort of a fiction now, it's not even a country anymore, even though we're trying to pretend it is, and the Iranians certainly want to keep it as a country. Just walk us through the realities of what's happening and what we might end up with in this region.
I think this is a great question, because one of the, if we see, for example, a fight, a serious battle against both ISIS and the PKK at the same time. That, on the short run, in the short term, might strengthen Erdogan's hand. But I think there is a danger there as well for Turkey internally, because there have been large numbers of Turks who have joined ISIS as well as other radical Syrian opposition groups. There are many Kurds who have been radicalized and have been angered by the government's policy during the Kobani fight, when the Turkish government refused to allow them Kurds to volunteer. They allowed only something like 150 to 200 fighters from Iraq. And so many Turkish Kurds were very much angered by the position of the government, which did not move to attack ISIS, and at the same time seem to be blaming the Kurds for a great deal of what's been going on. And so that means, with the fact that there might be sleeping cells of ISIS inside Turkey, as well as PKK fighters and supporters, we are likely to see a very dangerous situation developing on the ground in Turkey. Now, if Turkey, however, concentrates on the PKK, that's one thing, and basically goes through the motions in terms of ISIS, that might be able to borrow some time. But the danger is that some of these organizations, as we talked about earlier, the problem with these radical organizations sometimes is that they become much bigger than even their they could no longer be controlled by their supporters, by the people who arm them and the people who finance them. And we are seeing something like this with ISIS expanding beyond Syria, beyond Iraq, even into Libya, into Boko Haram, with Boko Haram in Nigeria, with into Algeria, into Tunisia, into the Afghanistan, the Caucasus, and that becomes much more complex, much more dangerous situation. So a great deal is going to depend now on where do we go from here in terms, first, of the internal situation in Turkey. Is there a chance of having a coalition government, which I think are very, if not impossible, very, very small? And the second thing, are we likely to see Turkey participating in the fight against ISIS fully in the same way it's likely to continue the fight against the PKK? And then will Turkey try to establish as we have heard in the past, and there have been hints that Turkey may want to establish a safe zone inside Turkey, inside Syria near the Turkish border. That's also another problem that's going to be facing both the Syrian regime on the one hand, the Syrian opposition, as well as the Turkish government.
Well, Edmund Gariba, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Edmund Gariba, who's an internationally recognized expert on the Kurds and Iraq. He was the first Mustafa Barzani Scholar of Global Kurdish Studies at the Center for Global Peace at American University, and was formerly a professor at Georgetown University, George Washington University, and the University of Virginia. And his books include The Historical Dictionary of Iraq, The Kurdish Question in Iraq, The Kurdish Nationalist Movement, and War in the Gulf, which he co-authored with Majid Haduri. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.